Thank you for downloading the Plod podcast, Police Law on Demand, brought to you by 3D solicitors and barristers from Sergeants in Chambers. In our podcast series, we are going to discuss a range of topics affecting police officers and anyone involved in the criminal justice system. For more updates on police law, follow the Sergeants in Police Law blog at ukpolicelawblog.com. If you have any suggestions for any topics that you would like us to cover, please email plod@3d-solicitors.com.
My name is Deborah Brittstone of 3D Solicitors, and I'm joined today by Alexander DeSantos, the barrister at Sergeants in Chambers, to discuss the issue of expert evidence in police misconduct cases, and particularly how such evidence should be presented to a panel, whether you're acting for the appropriate authority or the officer. Good afternoon, Alex.
Good afternoon.
So what kind of problems can arise when deploying expert evidence in police misconduct cases?
Well, the biggest problem quite often is complexity and what that then leads to in terms of both the panel being able to follow the evidence and also the advocates having a full chance to flesh out things that may be important to their case. And it's worth always remembering that you shouldn't ordinarily have expert evidence at all in a case unless it goes to issues that won't be within the ordinary experience of the panel. And so necessarily, when you do engage experts, you're going into topics that have a high likelihood of being complex in certainly the methodology, or would have concepts that might be outside the ordinary understanding of panel members.
So how would that evidence be received on that basis then? Can panels follow it easily? And particularly where you may have, for example, two experts, one for the appropriate authority or one for the officer?
Well, herein lies one of the difficulties, because the ordinary way of things is that you call experts during the course of your case, and you may very well have an expert give evidence, think that all the issues have been flushed out. And then when you hear the second expert give evidence, and that might be quite some time later, it may even be days or in some cases, you know, longer than days away, and you suddenly then have a new perspective of the same issues, you may find that having heard the second expert, there are questions you really wish you'd asked of the first expert. And also, it may be more difficult to follow. So just imagine this example. A panel member suddenly thinks, well, actually, a different opinion was given by the first expert, who's right. And when they try and explain to the second expert what they're getting at, they might not entirely and faithfully reflect what the first expert said. So it can be a more difficult task, even for them, to try and dig into the expert evidence. They can reach their conclusions.
Yeah, especially as you say, if something arises in the evidence of the second expert, which it would have been helpful to have dealt with when the first expert gave their evidence. So what would you suggest as a way to try and practically deal with that to make it easier for panels to follow?
In those cases where the evidence isn't so straightforward that you can deal with it in the ordinary way, there is a concept known as concurrent evidence. It has the nickname hot tubbing, which is certainly used frequently in the New Zealand jurisdiction. But the essence of the idea is that you call both experts at the same time. And so rather than having a gap between the evidence, you end up being able to have them both in the witness box at the same time, so that you manage to really exhaust the evidence and dig into it with both of them there at the same time.
Is that something that's been done in other jurisdictions?
Yes, more commonly, you'll find it in the general civil law jurisdiction. And the civil procedure rules deal with it at CPR 35 PD 11, the White Book. So that's practice direction 11, under the heading of concurrent expert evidence. And what the White Book does is sets out broadly four paragraphs and how this works. In essence, with that power, I should say, it's always open to a court managing its process to decide whether that's the appropriate way to hear such evidence.
Is it something that you've used before?
Yes, I've used it in different contexts and actually found it to be by far and away the absolute best way of dealing with experts, because it's really meant that the courts were more generous in cases I've dealt with, where they permitted the advocates to have multiple goes, essentially, because often they ask questions and the judge does. So you really get to bottom out issues before you move on. And more often you get a general understanding about what the experts say and really why they differ.
And how would it work then in practice?
So in practice, if I just follow, for example, what it says in the CPR about this, the first thing is, of course, you need to have experts in the same discipline, and that's really quite important. It's almost certainly obvious from what I've said previously, but you wouldn't call two different experts at the same time. So the first thing is, assuming that they are from the same discipline, you would have the court make a decision that this is how the evidence shall be received. They will, of course, follow the usual route of trying to agree matters between themselves in the first place. So you would still expect there to be a joint report which sets out the areas of agreement and disagreement, and those are areas that you'll normally then be exploring in their evidence. Now, how that's actually done, the court could set an agenda, which is one way where essentially you do it by topics, or and this is something that's found generally in other proceedings, is using a Scott schedule, and that's a table that has, assuming for a moment you had claimant, defendant, or here the AA and the officer, you would have, for example, in the obviously on the far left hand side, the number of each issue, you know, issue 1, 2, 3, 4. You then have a description of what that issue is. So just, it could be, for example, level of intoxication, or it could be level of testosterone in the individual system. And then what you'd have is the AA's contention. And then the next column would be the officer's contention. And there'd be a gap. And after that, the final column would be for the panel to note down what their conclusions are. And the point of the document is that it enables you to essentially just ring fence issue by issue. And once you've broken the case down into an issues-based approach, you would then call both experts at the same time. So they both enter and either go to the seating area where they're giving evidence in a police misconduct scenario, or they would go into a witness box in civil proceedings. Obviously, they're not sworn in misconduct proceedings, but they would be elsewhere. But they'll generally sit side by side, and you'll often go from one to the other. So you might say, for example, Mr. X, you've said that this, to give an example, depression is mild. Mr. Y, you've said it's a moderate. Why is it moderate rather than mild? And once the expert's given his or her explanation, you can go back and say, well, you've heard the basis for that conclusion. Why is that wrong? And so it enables you to essentially go from one expert to the other and get through the issue, really testing the evidence through the mouth of the other expert, provoking them to give the reason why the expert opposing side is wrong. And ultimately, normally the panel will decide whether an issue has really come to an end, check with the advocates, then move on to the next issue. So that's, in practice, that's what it looks like from the perspective of the advocates and also the panel.
So then it can apply in police misconduct tribunals, in your view?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I'm certainly am aware of it happening on the matters, and I have a matter at the moment where panel's being asked to consider it. And just in terms of how it might be considered in police misconduct, of course, Regulation 414, the 2020 regulations, provides that the person conducting or chairing misconduct proceedings must determine the procedure at those proceedings. And insofar as it's set out in these regulations, must determine it according to these regulations. And of course, what the panel or the LQC will be concerned with overall is fairness to both parties and the convenient and just disposal of the allegations that are made.
So what advice would you give to practitioners in terms of thinking about the evidence being given in this way before a panel?
Well, the first thing is really identifying whether or not this is the appropriate forum, because whilst it's a very effective tool for exploring expert evidence, It may very well be that it's not necessary because the issues are so clearly defined and within the ability, you may think of the panel to be able to look at them with evidence being dealt with in the usual way. But where you've got two experts and they are dealing with technical issues, and that's really when this comes into its own, things that often they're using different kinds of language that we're not used to using for concepts. And the first thing you do, you must really identify this as an early opportunity. And you'll, of course, the next stage is keep it under review whilst you have the joint experts meeting. And having that in mind, it's also useful when you're framing questions or parameters or an agenda for that joint experts meeting. But those are the early stages. You will need to raise it at an early stage at a pre-hearing. And you can do it. And what I would normally suggest you do is obviously contact the, if you're acting for the AA, contact the officer. If you're acting for the officer, contact the AA and propose this and see whether or not there can't be a measure of agreement. If there is, then you, of course, will want to notify the LQC of this and see whether it's something the LQC will agree to. If there's any hesitation by the LQC or the parties can't agree, then it's worth setting out at a pre-hearing why you're proposing this course. And if you're doing that, it really is worthwhile just taking some examples from the evidence you've received and saying that it may be obvious in a clear reading what you may think of X or Y. But just give an example about how it might be useful to panel to have, where there's a difference, those differences explored concurrently so that the panel is in the best position to make their decision. And I think the key is to just remind the panel that you're trying to make their job easier. What you will then do is, if the LQC is agreeable, is think about what directions are appropriate. And it may be quite simple to set out either an agenda or a Scott schedule by reference to the joint experts report, because in that, usually if they've listed the areas of agreement and disagreement, you probably will find the areas of disagreement give you a very good basis for either that agenda or Scott schedule. But do think about whether or not that can be broken down anymore. So it might be the conclusions 1 to 5, but behind that, it may be apparent from the longer reports that their methodology is slightly different. And so you might want to think about that and then see if you can agree either that agenda or Scott schedule ahead of the hearing. Do, of course, make sure you can find a date when both experts are available.
Sure. And some really useful tips there for us to think about in those circumstances. Thank you very much. That was really helpful. And hopefully we'll all be seeing experts giving evidence at the same time in future hearings.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for downloading the Plod podcast, Police Law on Demand, brought to you by 3D Solicitors and barristers from Sergeants in Chambers. For more updates on police law, follow the Sergeants in Police Law blog at ukpolicelawblog.com. If you have any suggestions for any topics that you would like us to cover, please email plod@3d-solicitors.com.